are back here on After Dark Radio, afterdarkradioshow.com. Brian Alvarez here, joined by a very special guest today. In fact, quite frankly, the biggest guest that we've ever had in the history of this show, Stanton T. Friedman, is here on the line. We're going to be talking his latest book, Flying Saucers and Science. A scientist investigates the mysteries of UFOs, interstellar travel, crashes, and government cover-ups. Stan Friedman is here on the line. Stanton, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. I'm not the biggest. I don't weigh that much. Come on.
I can't even tell you how excited I am to have you on the show today. And it's funny because I don't even have any idea where to start. You've been doing this for quite a while. I don't want to say forever, of course, but you've been doing this for
almost forever. I first got interested in flying saucers in 1958, which is a long time ago. And I've been lecturing since 1967. So, yeah, I've been keeping busy on the UFO scene. This is after spending 14 years in industry working on the development of a wide variety of very exciting advanced nuclear and space systems, which eventually got canceled. That was my specialty, canceled programs for GE, GM, Westinghouse, nuclear airplanes, nuclear rockets, nuclear power plants for space. Very exciting until they canceled the program. Now my own boss for since 1970, and nobody cancels my program.
Now let me ask you about that, because you as noted, were working in industry, and at one point you decided, okay, I'm going to go, I guess, into business for myself is the best way to put it, but this is going to be my job. I'm going to be a professional ufologist, and that's a big step to take.
Well, it came about gradually, and it came about, how shall I put it, with all the signs that the planets were in the right place. I did not set out to do this. I even ordered my first book only because I needed one more book from a discount bookseller in New York so I wouldn't have to pay shipping. I'm a cheapskate, and they had a $2.95 hardcover book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Air Force Captain Edward Ruppelt, who had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. This was 1958, and it was marked down to a dollar, which is what shipping charges would have been. So it wasn't going to cost me anything. I figured, what the heck? I bought the book. I was very intrigued. I loaned it to my neighbor, who was 10 years older than I was, and an engineer, and he was more impressed than I was. And, you know, interesting reading. I got to California, had a good librarian, and read 15 more books, some of which were utter trash. If I'd read them first, I would never have read another one. But then I discovered the Mother Lode, Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14. Mm-hmm. Biggest study ever done for the United States Air Force, but not mentioned in any of the books that I had read. Furthermore, it had 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. And most disturbing, though, it had a press release which quoted the Secretary of the Air Force from 1955. The study was finished then, but they didn't mention the title of the report. They didn't say who did the work, but they had the Secretary of the Air Force, of all people, lie through his teeth. He said, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those publicly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% I'm certain that even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Now, the only trouble with that statement is that it's a total lie. The unknowns, I had the report, the unknowns were 21.5%, which is a long way from 3 in my mathematics. And it was a separate category by definition, insufficient information. There wasn't enough data available about a sighting. Could not be listed as an unknown, the only ones we're interested in. Furthermore, they did an obvious and sensible thing. They compared the unknowns, the only ones we're interested in, to the knowns and found that the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. They found the better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable. Those comments made me mad. I've been working under security, and sometimes you sort of tiptoe around the truth. But blatant, flat-out lying from an official at that rank? That made me mad. And so I got determined to find out more. I joined APRO and NICAP. But it was still only, you know, lunchroom discussion with my scientific colleagues. And then a crazy thing happened. Frank Edwards came out with a book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. It was a bestseller. He was a newsman in Indianapolis, to which I had moved after the California job fell through. And I wrote Frank. I'd gotten to know him. And I had, by this time, moved to Westinghouse in Pittsburgh, Astronuclear Lab, working on nuclear rockets. At least we made a few of those work. And I said, Frank, give me names. You know everybody. I want to go public. So he gave me a bunch of names. And you'll be pleased as a radio man that one of them was for the producer of a radio show in Pittsburgh called Contact, great name, for KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the bigger, older, 50,000-watt third-channel radio and, as it happens, television stations as well. So I called the station thinking that because I work for Westinghouse, he's really going to say, yeah, let's get you on. What he said was, that's nice. Don't call us. We'll call you. After less than a month, he called me at 6:30 to be on a 7 o'clock show because somebody had canceled.
Sure.
I don't know how many people I had called before they got to me, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel. But I live near the station, so I did the program. Somebody at work heard me. They she had a book review club. They were doing looking at Frank's book, asked if I would speak to her club. My first lecture was in her living room, and I did the show more, and I did more lectures. But the real breakthrough, and the reason I'm going through this, you'll see how I got to where I wound up. The real breakthrough came when I was riding one of 2 days in a three-year period to work. Westinghouse was out of town in a small town called Large. I lived downtown Pittsburgh. And I'm with Joanne, a supervisor, PhD from Carnegie Tech. I said, boy, I'd like to speak at Carnegie Tech. She says, why don't you talk to the dean? And I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. So I did. And Jean was delighted. Oh, yeah, I'd love to have you. And we booked a date a few weeks later, but it was during the day. And his final question, of course, was, how much do you want? And I thought, well, I'm going to take some time off work. I'll ask for 100. He'll knock me down to 50, but what the heck? This is back in 67, mind you.
Sure.
He bought me at 100, and then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series, 1500, 1700, 1600. Well, because the talk went extremely well, he wrote a letter to the agent through whom he had booked the other speakers, telling him what a great job I had done, and the agent booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit for $300 in expenses. Wow, I was in the big time, you know. They were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative question. That impressed the heck out of me, not the money, but the fact that here's 1,000 engineers. I mean, Detroit was a big engineering place, you know, and no nasty questions. So I did a lot more professional groups. I was very pleased with the response, and one was another one was of particular importance for two reasons. Get a call from a colleague of mine at Los Alamos National Laboratory working on nuclear rocket shielding, as I was. Stan, how about speaking to the local section of the American Nuclear Society? Oh, I'd love to. No, I mean on an expense account. Oh, I don't make those decisions. Let me ask management. Would you believe they sent me from Pittsburgh to Los Alamos on an expense account to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the local section of the American Nuclear Society?
Hmm.
They had over 500 people. Again, no negativity. Now, I mention this because these were the kind of organizations that I was speaking to that were responding so well. So when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, as it did not long thereafter, I went full-time, never thinking I'd be spending the rest of my life, you know. But one nice thing, I'm my own boss.
That's true.
You know, I was sick and tired of moving my family because of changing programs and locations. I've had the ability to get more lectures, I didn't have to retire at age 65, and I've gotten to see the world. I've lectured in all 50 states, in all 10 Canadian provinces, and in 18 other countries. And the interest is still there. And people say, when are you going to retire, Stan? And I say, why should I retire? I'm healthy. I like what I'm doing. I like my boss, as long as I can keep doing it. And people want me. And, you know, this year, since mid-January, I have spoken in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in Warsaw, Poland, in St. John's, Newfoundland, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, in California, Arizona, Georgia, Kansas, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New Hampshire. I've been getting around, so people are interested.
Well, one of the great things about the book and you in general is you are 77 years old and in good health.
Yep.
And you've been doing this for a long time. So sometimes people read books about UFOs, and this is somebody, you know, they're in their 20s, 30s writing this book, and they're going back and trying to research stuff. You were there for a lot of these different things, and you were investigating these things before they were even big stories. The Majestic 12 documents, for example. I mean, you had heard about these things before the story even broke, and you've been following it in depth and have been a part of the story the entire track. So,
oh, yeah, and my book, Top Secret Magic, and deals with that. And incidentally, there is a option for a movie called Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C. They've optioned my life story, the book Top Secret Magic, and Don Schmidt's book, Witness to Roswell. The screenplay's been written. Now all we need to do is find the guy with the money and get, Dustin Hoffman to play me in the movie, and we'll be all set.
Sure. You know, the thing about the Majestic 12 documents, I just finished reading your book, in fact, and it was great because, you know, when you follow this topic and big stories break and they get kind of big for a while and then they kind of fade away, and, you know, you hear one side talking about this, you hear the other side talking about this, and it kind of goes back and forth, and sometimes you sort of get muddled and you kind of sit in here and you go, okay, what does everybody believe about the Majestic 12 documents nowadays? And actually, the answer is nobody agrees on anything, because there are a lot of people that believe they're forgeries, and you make a great case in the book for these documents being real. And
three of them, as a matter of fact.
I also make the case
that there are over 100 phony documents. But, you know, that's my nuclear background. Only one uranium atom out of 140 is fissionable in a normal reactor.
Mm-hmm.
So we use it. So the fact that most of these documents are fraudulent, so what? I mean, I'm like the basketball coach. Yeah, I know most people aren't 7 feet tall. Give me one guy who is. I don't care about all the midgets in the world. So with the MJ-12 documents, I've tried to zero in on all the objections from the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm being polite, and deal with them. And I've made my business, I've been to 20 document archives. Now, most of the guys who talk sit at home at their desk, you know, and think they can tell you what's going on just from their own experience. One guy says, for example, one of the arguments, these documents don't have top secret control numbers on them, and all top secret documents have to have top secret control numbers, so they must be fraudulent. Well, when you go to the archives, you find documents, top secret documents, without top secret control numbers. Not all of them, some of them. I have statements on record from the Eisenhower Library, the Marshall Archives. We have many top secret documents without top secret control numbers. And in case people are wondering, well, how could that be? The point is, if you have one copy of a document to go from General A to General B, he doesn't want to go through all the paperwork kind of thing. If you've got 20 copies going to 20 different people, you have to have control numbers because you need to inventory this stuff. Mm-hmm. You have to keep track of all top secret documents, but not with control numbers for ones that don't require it. But, I mean, that's typical. Well, my favorite example is Philip Klass, who was the noisiest negativist of them all, senior avionics editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology in Washington, wrote several books, anti-UFOs. He complained about one of these three documents is done in the large pica type. But he had documents, all of nine, from the National Security Council showing that they used only elite type. And he challenged me to find any genuine documents using the same size and style type. And he had some kickers. They had to be signed and had to get them someplace like the Eisenhower Library, et cetera. It turns out he'd never been to the Eisenhower Library. He got nine documents by mail. They happened to all be small elite type. So he jumped to a major conclusion. They got 250,000 pages there. To suggest that on the basis of nine, you can say they're all done with the same typewriter is pretty foolish. I was going there. I got a bunch of documents done, meeting all his requirements, sent him copies of 14. He set a maximum limit, up to 10. He'd pay me $100 each for every genuine document with the same large Pika type.
Too bad for you.
That it was only 10. Yes. Because I sent him the invoice, and he paid me $1,000. He didn't tell anybody about paying me. He told everybody about challenging me before that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's typical of the rather stupid notions that have stood in the way and the people who refuse to do their homework. One guy said, hey, it lists the members here, and it says the briefing officer was Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, but he was only a rear admiral. Obviously, the document's fraudulent. Well, when you go to the Eisenhower Library again, you find that the use of generic ranks was standard. In other words, you use the word general for a brigadier, a major, lieutenant, and four-star. Admiral for rear, and vice admiral, and full admiral, and stuff. Now, in other words, a lieutenant colonel can answer the phone, Colonel Jones. He signs it, lieutenant colonel. I found many examples of this and talked to two archivists about it. But these guys don't go to archives. They don't check. So it's been an interesting hunt, if you will, and I learned a lot, about noisy negativism, which I don't know that I needed to learn that, but three documents are sound, and they're the most important classified documents ever leaked to the American public. There's over 100 that are phony. So what? It's standard practice for governments to put out phony stuff when good stuff comes out that they don't want out. They hope the phony stuff will rub off on the good stuff, you know, and you don't worry about that anymore. Everybody thinks they're phony, ha-ha, you know. So my goal in all this stuff, I bring to the table a few special characteristics. One, I worked under security for 14 years, so I understand how security works. I wrote classified documents. I've been to 20 archives, and I get some people saying, just as an example, that, oh, everything is automatically declassified after 25 years. Not true. They come up with these phony baloney arguments, which sound good, but, and remember, this was all before computers took over. So, you know, offices had different typewriters, had different styles. Had, and one said, the date format is wrong, 18 November, 1952. That comma shouldn't be there. These are phony documents. Well, if you go to the archives, I found one file folder had seven different date formats. Mm-hmm. So you got to be persistent, and you got to get upset at the idiots, so you persist digging out the good stuff. One crazy thing, one of the 12 people listed as a member of this super special group, Operation Majestic 12, was a Harvard professor of astronomy, Dr. Donald Menzel, mm-hmm. well-known around the world, expert on eclipses and a lot of other things. And he also wrote four anti-UFO books. So everybody's saying, hey, he couldn't lead a double life. I'd done a paper on the double life of Donald Menzel. Because I went to the Harvard archives after getting permission from three different people, including his wife, to look at his papers. He was dead, of course, as all these guys were when we got the documents. And I discovered to my total surprise, I didn't like the guy when he was alive. We'd had a run-in. And discovered he wrote to Jack Kennedy things like, when we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more about the National Security Agency. Turns out he had a longer continuous association with them, more than 30 years at the time, of anybody in the country. And he had a top secret ultra clearance. He was a world-class cryptographer, all kinds of other stuff that none of us knew. I mean, offhand, you'd say, you don't need a high-level security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. but he had it. And to my satisfaction, it was clear from the data I found by going to the archives and digging out this stuff that indeed he belonged on this group. And I got people telling me who didn't do any research, he couldn't lead a double life. Well, I hate to say it, but every outstanding spy leads a double life, doesn't he? You know, what? As an example of that, three Englishmen, Burgess, Philby, and McLean, were Soviet spies working in MI5. Mm-hmm. Now, you got to be careful when you do that, because you can't reveal information that somebody will know where it has to have come from, you know. So that's one thing, security. Secondly, unlike almost all the people in the field, I worked on advanced propulsion systems, fusion rockets, fission rockets, nuclear power plants for space. This is important because the automatic reaction of the nasty, noisy negativist is, you can't get here from there. Well, if you use a bicycle, you can't. But, you know, we've had one of the stories in Science Was Wrong, which is an even later book than Flying Saucers in Science, is about the resistance to new means of propulsion, like airplanes, for example. Greatest astronomer of the 19th century said, man will never fly any distance in an airplane. 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight, mind you. And so, can you get to the stars? Well, not in a dumb old chemical rocket. If you make enough stupid assumptions, you can prove anything is impossible. You know, but I've worked in that area. I know about those things. I have the examples of Dr. Campbell, Canadian astronomer, 1941, calculated the required initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Legitimate question. Pages of equations. Published in an article, Scientific Journal. Bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons. Even for me, that's too big. Funny thing, we got three guys to the moon and back, still with a dumb old chemical rocket, mm-hmm. whose initial launch weight was 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. If you make enough stupid assumptions, you can prove anything. He assumed a single-stage rocket, 1G limit on acceleration. He assumed that you'd have to use a retro rocket, which is very wasteful because you got to launch it and slow it down and without it doing anything until you're coming back. We used the atmosphere. Remember Apollo 13. Being smart's more important than being powerful. He also made an interesting assumption that, of course, the rocket has to provide all the energy. We use cosmic freeloading. Why is there a launch window to go to the moon? Because if you wait to the right time, the moon will do much of the work for you. We've got the Cassini spacecraft out at Saturn. Been there for a couple of years, learning all kinds of stuff about the satellites of Saturn. But we sent it in closer to the sun to go past Venus and get a free kick. Mm-hmm. Came back past Earth, got another free kick. Went out past Jupiter and got booted again. So being smart's more important than being powerful. And so this is a place where I take on the noisy negativists, and astronomers know nothing about deep space travel. They make all these dumb assumptions, and they're easy to take care of. A third thing that I bring to this subject is that I've had to answer, I once figured, over 50,000 questions. I've given over 700 lectures. I've only had 11 hecklers, incidentally, and two of them were drunk, because that tells you something.
It's a pretty good track record, actually.
What?
It's a pretty good track record.
I'm told you get more than that if you talk about sports, religion, or politics, but I don't talk about those things.
Sure.
But what I found is that I had to think about all the why questions. You know, why would they come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? And most people haven't thought about that. And the usual response I get to my answers, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that sounds right. So, you know, I've had experience of doing that. And finally, I found that I enjoyed being on the stage. And because of my high school debating, I had built into me the notion, you got to know your opponent's arguments. Because in debating, you never know which side you're going to be on. You know?
Sure.
So you got to know both sides of the story. And I'll say one thing. There are four basic rules for the debunkers used all the time, and it doesn't matter what the subject is. You can debunk anything with these. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. Nobody will know the difference anyway. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation's too much trouble. So if you keep those in mind, it's not hard to take on the nasty, noisy negativists. I've won debates. Seth Shostak and I of the SETI Institute. You know what SETI stands for? Silly Effort to Investigate. S-E-T-I. We did a debate on Coast to Coast Radio. I got 57% of the vote. He got 33, and 10% said, I don't know. In other words, this is a serious subject which requires that you spend some effort and time, or else shut up or preface your remarks with, well, I don't really know anything about this, but here's my off-the-top opinion. And I eat those guys for lunch. And that's a challenge to any of your listeners, incidentally, if they can arrange it.
But, indeed. You know, one of the things you talked about in the book, I just wanted to mention this, because I'd often thought this, not necessarily about UFOs, but about other government secrets. And that is that people will often say, okay, this can't be real, because you could never get, you know, 5,000 people to keep quiet about anything. And as you note in your book, from experience and working with everything that you've done, you can, in fact, keep lots of people quiet about top secret projects, including the Manhattan Project. And that was kind of one of the things in the book where I read it and I was like, man, you know, I had never thought of that before, but that is true.
Well, the Bletchley Park in England was the location where very smart Englishmen. We had broken the German communications code. And we had 12,000 people working there, intercepting, which was easy, German communications, decoding, which wasn't easy, and then giving it to only those people who needed it. Because if the Germans found out that we'd broken the code, they would change it, and we'd be up the creek without a paddle. And it was extraordinarily important that we had done that. Now, you'd think, oh, the war's over. We're going to tell everybody how smart we were. Not one word in public for 25 years from those 12,000 people. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, incidentally, was there were other countries using those codes, those machines, and we were listening to their mail, too, their communications. But, you know, 12,000, look at the stealth aircraft. Lockheed spent $10 billion over 10 years in secret. And one of the things that I've come to appreciate is the fact that many of the ancient academics and fossilized physicists, as I call them when I'm being polite, seem not to understand that an awful lot of work gets done outside of academia, research and development work. Mm-hmm. I had two different people tell me, Stan, if Roswell had happened, and I'm the original civilian investigator, and yes, I think it did, if Roswell had happened, they'd have had to pull half the scientists in the country out of universities. And I laughed and said, you've got to be kidding. Los Alamos had 8,000 people working there. There's Oak Ridge. There's Hanford. There's a whole bunch of places. Loads of good work is done outside of academia. After all, when I was in industry, it wasn't publish or perish. It was get the job done. When I was working on nuclear airplanes for GE, 1958, we spent $100 million that year, employed 3,500 people full-time, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That wasn't six professors and 12 grad students. It was a major activity, and there have been lots of them. I mentioned in the book, I think, about the Boeing had a contract with the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, one of the big black budget agencies, to change the architecture, if you will, of some of our spy satellites. The NRO is the big guy on the block. Some of their satellites can cost $500 million, would you believe? And the contract, they spent $18 billion over a several-year period, didn't get what they want, and had to cancel it. $18 billion is a lot of people, a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of energy. In secret. And, well, our first spy satellite, the Corona, I used to own a Toyota Corona, so and I like smoking Corona cigars when I get the chance.
Sure.
In Canada, of course. You can't have them in the United States.
No.
But the Corona spy satellite, our first successful one, and there were 12 failures, that didn't stop, was in 1960. It got more data about Soviet military installations than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. There was no public discussion. There were several of these Corona satellites. No public discussion about Corona until 1995, 35 years later. Can't keep secrets? You gotta be kidding.
That was a real eye-opener for me, I gotta say.
Well, good.
Because, I mean, you read, I mean, anything you read about any sort of conspiracy, you know, we don't need to get into JFK here, but the anniversary is coming up. But one of the things, I mean, whether you believe it or not, one of the arguments against a conspiracy is always, well, nobody could keep this secret for so long. And I read the book, and it was kind of like, well, maybe it would be unlikely, but it is possible. And that's an eye-opener.
Good. We want to open a lot of eyes. And also, I want to make people understand that we're at a turning point in history. We used to think Copernicus was right. You remember old Nick, 1543, he said, believe it or not, that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. My goodness.
Oh, my.
He would have been burned at the stake, except he died that year, and Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for agreeing with him. The book was banned for 300 years. The sun's the middle of the universe, is the net output of that. Now we realize that the sun isn't the middle of anything. It's our little star. We didn't think there were any planets out there. Oh, cripes, they're all over the place. The SETI people are content to say, Frank Drake has publicly stated, there might be as many as 8,000 places in our galaxy where there could be beings sending signals. Why they would send them, I don't know. And why we'd hope to be able to understand them, decode them, I don't know. But the new Kepler satellite data, it's looking at a chunk of the sky about the size of your fist at arm's length, a small portion of the sky. Over and over again, it follows, it moves out and back and tracks planets moving across the face of their stars. Their conclusion is there's probably 8 billion places in the galaxy. And I get people saying, look how much energy it would take to get to the next galaxy. I don't care about the next galaxy. Zeta Reticuli, two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, they're 39.3 light years away, just down the street. These stars come out of the star map and captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience.
Mm-hmm.
And my co-author is Betty's niece, Kathleen Marden, has all her tapes and all the rest of that. But the important thing is Zeta 1 and Zeta 2, 39.3 light years away, but only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. We're out in the boonies, next star over 4.3 light years from the sun. These guys are only an eighth of a light year apart. And, oh, isn't it strange? They're a billion years older than the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that we're the most advanced guys around here seems utterly absurd, and they would have great incentive to develop interstellar travel. You can see the other star all day long from a planet around the other one. Entirely different situation. And the notion that we're the big shots is ridiculous. I got my own comeuppance. I was telling a group at the University of Detroit how rapidly science has changed. And, technology and look at the computers and all that stuff. And I casually said, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule. Looked around the class, not one batted eye. So finally, any of you guys know what a slide rule is? Not one. In the class of, about 100 students from a total of two classes.
Mm-hmm.
That was less than 50 years, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
You know, what are we going to be doing 50 years from now? I mean, I look at this computer in front of me, and it isn't fancy. When you realize what this would have been worth if you had a bunch of them back 50 years ago.
I look at my phone all the time, and it's like, you know, I remember when I was in high school. I'm much younger than you, but in high school I had like a pager, a beeper.
Yeah.
And now it's like, you know, who uses their phone for phone calls, their cell phone? You know, you make a call here and there, but largely you're checking your email, you're going online, you're sending text messages. You know, 10 years ago, even that is just like, you know, nobody was looking forward 10 years and going, my phone is going to be my access to my buddy here via text message. It's things change very quickly.
That, you know, to me, that the phone is an incredible piece of machinery. And, you know, when I started working in industry, the computer was up in another building. You filled out input data sheets. A girl key punched them. She took a box of cards and a big reel of tape up to this building and brought you back a pile of output information. And we paid $500 an hour for the use of that machine, incidentally. You didn't get anywhere near the computer, and 64K was a lot of storage. You mm-hmm. know?
Commodore 64.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so the world has changed a lot, and anybody who thinks we're on the top of the heap. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me as so strange is people can't imagine that aliens would come here for anything but to talk to us. You know, why don't they land on the White House lawn? They don't seem to realize that there's something special about Earth. We're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. Do you realize we've exploded 2,000 atomic bombs? Only two on people, thank goodness. But the reason for mentioning this, anybody studying would realize that, oh, we can go from fission to fusion and be able to get to the stars. There's a natural progression here. World War II, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. It released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Make a pretty big hole in the ground, too. That was in 42 or 43. 1945, first atomic bomb, about 16,000 tons of TNT equivalent. By 1952, our first H-bomb, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent. The fireball was 3 miles wide. And the Russians outdid us with a 50 million ton H-bomb. Now, I mention this because there was a parallel progression here. The nuclear navy, first nuclear submarine, Admiral Rickover and Company, 1956. The Nautilus, of course. Do you realize that we now have nuclear aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling? That's incredible to mm-hmm. me. And then, well, how about fusion? Well, if you use the right stuff in the right way and want to spend a lot of money, you can build a fusion propulsion system that will allow you to kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million tons. And incidentally, we operated fission nuclear rockets when I was at Westinghouse. The biggest one, Los Alamos, did 4,400 megawatts, and it was less than 7 feet in diameter. Now, to compare that, Hoover Dam is about 2,200 megawatts. There are two. I was thinking of Grand Coulee Dam. Twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam, which is awful big, in something 7 feet in diameter. We're already at that stage. So any smart alien, if you presume their concern is protecting their security and their future and all that, would realize that this is a primitive society. Our major activity is tribal warfare. In World War II, we killed 50 million of our own kind. We destroyed 1,700 cities. Now, would any alien want us to take our brand of friendship out there? I don't think so. The military budget on the planet this year is $1 trillion. $1 trillion. And, what, 20,000 kids die every single day of preventable disease or starvation? That tells you a lot about the planet, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Of course they'd want to come here to make sure we don't go out there. And landing on a White House lawn, I mean, I'm sure all your listeners realize the President of the United States doesn't speak for 7 billion Earthlings.
Mm-hmm.
Has trouble often speaking for 300 million Americans. And incidentally, did you see the story about the White House comments about alien visitations?
Recently? No.
Yeah, this past week. There was a petition. They set up a procedure at the White House that you can submit a petition if you get more than 5,000 signatures. They've just upped the number to 25,000. Anyway, one was submitted asking that the president release all the information we have about alien visitations, really. Well, we just got a response back. The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. In addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye.
Well, that's a lie.
It's a total lie, and I just written my monthly column for the MUFON Journal, in which I point out a few facts, there are a number of large-scale scientific studies that show there are visitors coming. There are a number of abductions, again, the Hill case being an excellent example of contact with the members of the human race and aliens. And no information being hidden. I always got a laugh at my lectures when I showed a blacked-out CIA UFO document on which you can read 8 words.
Or whiteout.
That's the National Security Agency. 156 NSA UFO documents were released. You can read one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out.
See, that's interesting there, because even if you don't believe that aliens have visited the Earth, it's still a lie. It's still a lie to claim that nothing is being withheld from the public. That is a lie.
Yeah, it very clearly is. So I'm looking for a forum. I wish Larry King were still on.
Sure.
Get on. But I'd be happy to debate these members of the Office of Scientific Policy. But this is blatant. And, you know, they did something clever, you might say. Bait and switch. They give these answers, and then they say, but, on the other hand, we are looking at life outside. We're talking about SETI. We're talking about Kepler. Take those. You don't need to worry about this UFO stuff. Well, that's bait and switch. The petition talked about alien life coming here. It didn't talk about what's going on out there, about which we know nothing. And one of the puzzles of this time in history is, why are so many smart people totally avoiding dealing with the evidence that aliens are coming here and anxious to talk about theorizing about, gee, how likely is it that we'll find somebody out there? We know nothing about out there. You know, I can tell you the odds of tossing an 8 with a pair of dice, because I know how many sides there are in each die and what numbers are there. But how can I tell you the probability of encountering another civilization? All we can say is we know they're coming here. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't know what they're doing out there. Maybe this is the penal colony of the neighborhood. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're so nasty to each other. You know, the Australians take great pride in their convict ancestors, incidentally.
Now, let me ask you this question, because I want to make sure we talk about Roswell before we have to wrap this up today. You've got a big chapter, obviously, in the book, Flying Saucers and Science. A scientist investigates the mysteries of UFOs, interstellar travel, crashes, and government cover-ups. My question is, Jacques Vallée and many others have put forward the theory that these things have been visiting here forever. And you were just talking about World War II, the atomic bomb. Roswell, of course, happened just a couple of years later.
Yep,
Kenneth Arnold's sighting. My question to you is, what is your take on the historical aspect of UFOs, the Roswell crash and everything like that? Do you believe that that was a direct response to the fact that we set off atomic bombs? Or was it a coincidence that it just happened to catch the public eye around that time? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think at the end of World War II, there were 3 obvious signs that soon these idiot Earthlings would be moving out. High-power rockets, a German V-2, atomic bombs, and radar as an example of the beginning of the electronics age. There was no radar before the war in Europe began in the late 30s. Isn't it amazing? The only place where you could study all 3 of these was southeastern New Mexico. That's where the first atomic bomb was lit up at Trinity site. That's where we're firing to capture German V-2s. And that's where we had our best radar, because sometimes the rockets went south instead of north. The Mexicans weren't happy about that. So it would be no surprise. That's where Roswell is, too, I dare say. I think, yes, that the Grand Command Center of the Galactic Federation said, we got to keep our eyes on these idiots. I mean, they've been pretty harmless for the last 2,000 years. But look what they're doing now. Now they can reach us. So I think what happened at Roswell wasn't an intentional act to crash. Some people say, oh, they were trying to give us technology. You don't give a loaded gun to three-year-olds, maybe in Texas, but
sure.
Sorry. But so I think there has been an evolution. I think there is a galactic neighborhood. I think there are libraries, that there have been many civilizations who have gone through this phase of too much technology and not enough sociology, which clearly we are in. We're taxing the planet like anything. You know, we're not feeding enough people, all the rest. I don't need to tell you about what's going on the planet. So I think the aliens are concerned about themselves. And there's a book by a guy named Hastings, Nukes and UFOs, recording a lot of instances in which aliens have apparently interfered with the nuclear weapons. Malmstrom Air Force Base, for example, 10 Minuteman missiles went down when there was a UFO sitting over the front gate, one after the other. Now, that's not supposed to happen. In Russia, it was the other way. Suddenly, nuclear weapon-carrying rockets were online and ready to go, which scared the heck out of the commanding officer. But many instances like this, and there was a press conference in Washington, which a number of the people who were involved in these events firsthand were there. And speaking of firsthand, you know, people say, well, there's nobody alive from Roswell. One of the things that's listed on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com is a DVD called Recollections of Roswell. Firsthand testimony from 27 individuals, almost all of whom are dead and can't be interviewed by me. I mean, you may have some guests who can interview, but I don't know how to reach them. They've gone past the pale. So there is firsthand information about a lot of these things, which you can, if you make a little effort, get to. I recommend that one because I've met a lot of those people, of course, before they died.
Actually, the book Witness to Roswell is kind of like a book version of what you're talking about. And that was, I really liked that book. I thought it was compelling in the sense that even if you did not believe that an alien craft crashed at Roswell, when you read this book, I mean, it's very obvious that something happened. And,
no question.
Yeah, maybe you don't leave the book going, okay, it was an alien craft, but you leave the book going, okay, this was not a weather balloon that crashed. Something more happened here.
No, the same thing applies to my book, Crash at Corona. Corona's the town closest to where the Roswell incident happened. And that book, Witness to Roswell, is the other one with my top secret magic that will be the basis for this exciting, important, dramatic documentary, Magic Men, that'll be like all the President's Men and JFK combined. And Richard Dreyfuss playing me, as I say.
The actor changes every time.
but what I'm saying is, there's another movie coming up. Same people, Bryce Zabel is a wheel in Hollywood. Did the Dark Skies program many years ago, you know?
Yep.
They have captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. And that just happened very recently, so I'm pleased that'll be a second movie, he says, hopefully. I better warn listeners, you know, Hollywood talks a lot.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more talk than action. So people say, oh, when can I go see it? I say, wait a minute, we got a lot of steps between now and then.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just that, you know, I'm glad to have the option. We've had some good opinions from some people whose opinions are worth having, but nobody's writing checks yet, as far as I know. I hope they will. And I hate to admit it, damn, but what the heck? More people watch movies than read books.
That is unfortunately true.
Yeah, and so, you know, I've got five books out there, but more people will see the movie I'm sure, than I've read the books.
Well, one positive is that now all of your books, or many of your books, are starting to be available on the Kindle.
Yes.
And you can read those on your computer as well. I read the book on my iPad with the Kindle app, and it was great. And you can get it a little cheaper, too. So there's no excuse for people not to read nowadays.
Well, you're right. And, you know, I'm old-fashioned. I like to hold a book and carry it on the airplane. Mm-hmm. But I've seen guys with Kindles on airplanes, too. So whether we like it or not, technology is changing. And there's no sense in fighting it. The point is to go along with it. You know, I still like a book, but... You know,
there are other options.
There are other options, and I'm glad for that, because I've been told that for some book chains, they're selling more electronic books than they are...
Amazon is now. More e-books than physical books in Amazon.com.
Wow.
I want to ask...
Depressing, but what the heck...
Since you brought it up, I want to ask one final question here. I could seriously talk to you for about 10 hours, but we'll do another show sometime, hopefully. The Betty and Barney Hill, since you mentioned it a second time here, I always wanted to ask about the star map, because, you know, I heard
I
the story.
I was the first to publish about it, and that's where the information about Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli came from. What about it?
Now, when she... Okay, so I remember reading about this when I was a kid. Your book, actually. But I don't remember the exact details. When she was shown the star map, she basically asked, you know, where are you guys from? And she was shown a map. And,
well, map... People think of map as a two-dimensional thing like you get from the Shell Oil Company.
That's my question.
No, she described it as having depth. It was about 2 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet.
So it was a three-dimensional map. It wasn't like they put
a hologram, but we didn't have that term at the time.
I see.
The difficult thing was to find a three-dimensional pattern that matched the two-dimensional. That's where Marjorie Fish came in, who built more than 20 3D models of our local galactic neighborhood. It's labor to get copy out all the numbers for where to put the beads that were strung on fish line. And the first several models, she couldn't find a pattern that matched. But then she started listening to the astronomers who said, well, look, you're probably only going to have planets around sun-like stars. Not too old, not too new, not too variable in their energy output, not another one too close, et cetera, et cetera. So she started weeding out. Her first model had 256 stars in it. She wound up with one with fewer than 60 stars in it, but on which she found one and only one pattern that matched, angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. It was a big day for Marjorie.
See, that's interesting, because even if you presume that under hypnosis she, I don't know, was making it up, or she had had a dream or something like that, what are the odds that she would have later reproduced something that actually matched?
Essentially 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000,000, depending on who you ask. That's what was exciting. And the fact that all the pattern stars are connected with lines, heavy trade routes, light train routes, occasional expedition. The fact that all the sun-like stars in that volume of space are part of the pattern, and all the pattern stars are sun-like, that's where the chance is 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000,000. It's not a coincidence. Betty didn't know anything about astronomy. You know, and so it was very exciting. I was asked to look into it by the head of APRO, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. I met with Marjorie, looked at her work, followed her work over a period of time, published the first article about that work because I was so impressed. She had gone to visit Betty, starting as a non-believer, because she didn't think aliens would look humanoid. She had studied biology in college. She was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant one, a member of Mensa, et cetera. But then she started building these models. And in my movie, UFOs Are Real, which is also listed on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com, you will find comments from the head of the astronomy department at Ohio State University. He had his students look at her work and was convinced she did a very accurate job. And they used one of her models as a teaching tool. You don't often get a chance to get a three-dimensional view of where things are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard part, incidentally, you've got to transfer all those coordinates to put the sun at the center of the model. That's a lot of work, and she did an enormous amount of work. So, very exciting piece of work. And at one point, we thought somebody had goofed, because it was claimed that one of the two stars is a double star, and that was verboten. Well, it turns out it was Mickey's ears, an artifact of the process by which you determine whether the stars are double or not. And it was a referenced, unpublished comment, and I contacted the guys who had written that with my heart and my stomach, and it turns out, no, it's not a double. We goofed. So it's survived a lot of attacks. Carl Sagan attacked it. Everybody attacked it, misrepresented what she did. It's quite remarkable. So I'm satisfied the work is good. It's solid. Yes, we have better data now because we have the Hipparcos space satellite. Mm-hmm. You see, back then, it was hard to measure the distance to stars, but who cared? Nobody's going anywhere. But Hipparcos made millions of measurements, and so the data's a little more accurate now. Much more accurate, really, and very exciting, and the work still stands up. So I'm very pleased about that work. I got Astronomy Magazine to run an article about it. The editor was somebody I'd met, and they got more response than anything they'd ever published. They sold 10,000 copies of a 32-page booklet with the original article and all the comments from all these ancient academics, if you will. And then they put out the 32-page full-color booklet. They sold 10,000 copies in no time, which is unheard of for this kind of thing. But then Carl Sagan's lawyers threatened to sue the publishers of the publication, and he caved, and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I wound up with 18,000 copies of this booklet. They're all gone now, unfortunately. I could sell them all now. Mm-hmm. But great interest, wonderful piece of work, and it gives you a whole different perspective on, A, the contributions that amateurs can make. Mm-hmm. It's like discovering comets. Often amateurs do that. And also the resistance to truth on the part of the astronomical community. And I say that Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years. I was at his home a year before he died. We weren't battling with each other, and I wish he were still here. But he's got a thing about we can't give any credence to this UFO stuff. And the astronomical community is like that for reasons which I don't understand. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a dumb old physicist. But it's there. And so, Seth Shostak, where are you? I'll take you on again.
That's
anywhere,
right.
Anytime.
The book is Flying Saucers and Science, A Scientist Investigates the Mysteries of UFOs, Interstellar Travel, Crashes, and Government Cover-Ups. This book is great. I'm not just saying that because Stanton is here on the line. And one of the main reasons for that is you read a lot of books about this topic. Some are pro-alien. Some are, looking to debunk all of these stories. And many of them will take one stance, and they will stick to it. And what is great about this book is Stanton Friedman, throughout his career, has taken each case on a case-by-case basis. And we talked about it earlier with the Majestic 12 documents. Stan Friedman is not a guy who believes every single one of these documents is legitimate. He believes that three of them are, and the rest of them are not. And each case in this book, like I said, case-by-case basis. Some of this stuff he makes a great case for. I know a lot of you, we won't talk about it here, but you can read the book, Bob Lazar. There's a lot written about Bob Lazar in this book. A lot of people believe Bob Lazar's story. Some do not. And Stanton is one of those who does not. And if you want to know why, you can check out the book. But Stanton, I very much appreciate it. I love the book. And best of luck to you, and hopefully we can have you on again someday.
Hey, when the movies go big.
That's right. When the movies go big, we'll get you back. Thanks, everybody,
thanks
for listening. And, of course, thanks, Stanton. Check out StantonFriedman.com for more. And, of course, the book. And we'll talk to you again after a while.